I've been a pastor for many, many years, and in my capacity as a pastor, I've done some counseling with people. So I muster up all my abilities from my one counseling class that I had in seminary and counsel people to the best of my abilities. So I've sat with people and individuals who struggle with sadness and distress, who endure pain and suffering, who are depressed. And most, by and large, most of these people come to my office and sit on my sofa and talk about their relationships and how difficult their relationships are with their husband or their wife, or with their child, sometimes with their parents, their difficulty they have with someone at work or at school, someone who was supposedly their friend betrayed them. And what I've realized over the years is that there's basically two reasons why people struggle in the area of their relationships. One is forgiveness, inability to forgive someone, or the inability to have someone receive forgiveness, and reconciliation. The ability to bring back together a healthy, wholesome relationship. Forgiveness and reconciliation. Those are huge when it comes to relationships. I think as human beings, we have this tendency to instead of try to resolve our conflicts and try to come up with a relationship that's healthy and working, we lean towards retribution. We want to punish people. We want to walk away from a relationship that was fine before, but now something has happened in that relationship. People often find it easier to punish another person rather than do the work of forgiveness and reconciliation. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, if as I'm talking now, you're thinking about relationships that have gone off the rails in your life. Maybe it's with someone that are intimate with, a family member, someone you're married to, someone who was a close friend, someone who you trusted, and now it's not worth anything because of one of those two issues, forgiveness and reconciliation. And so today I do want to talk about those two things. Those two terms are not synonymous. So forgiveness and reconciliation do not mean the same thing, although sometimes people may use them in the same manner. I just have one big idea this morning I want you to maybe go away with, and that's simply this, that you can have forgiveness without reconciliation, but you cannot have reconciliation without forgiveness. You can have forgiveness without reconciliation, but you cannot have reconciliation without forgiveness. One is dependent upon the other. So I want to tell a story this morning about two men in the Bible. They're brothers. They happen to be twin brothers. The father's name is Isaac, and the mother's name is Rebecca. And when Rebecca got pregnant, she discovered she was having twins. And so the story says that in her womb, she could feel them fighting. So sometimes, you know, pregnant women, when the baby gets a little bigger, you can... The baby starts moving around and kicking and thrusting and pushing up against, you know, the mother's womb. And it's sort of freaky, right? If you haven't ever seen it before, it's like, whoa, it's like, what's in there? And so Rebecca could feel these two boys, these two children, not just moving around, but they were, in a sense, fighting with each other. And so the day came when she was to give birth, and the first boy that comes out is this hairy, red, hairy kid, right? Hair's covering him all over, and it's red. And so they named him Esau, which means red, hairy kid or something like that. And the second boy that comes out is holding on to Esau's heel. And as he comes out, they name him Jacob, which means grasp or hold on to. And so Isaac and Rebecca have these two boys, Jacob and Esau. Esau becomes, you can describe him as an outdoorsman. Like he likes to go out. He's in the wild all the time. You know, when the parents say, hey, go get some meat, he goes and hunts it and kills it and brings it in. Like he's that sort of guy. He's a rough and tumble sort of man. Jacob grows up to be this domesticated sort of guy. He likes working with the animals that are already in the playpen, right? So when the parents say, go get some meat, he's going to the pen to get a pig or a chicken or something, right? He's not going out and hunting it. Esau becomes Isaac's, the father's favorite, whereas Jacob becomes the mother's favorite. So one day, when Esau had been trying to find some hunting, some game in the field, and he didn't find anything, but he came back, he was super hungry. He's tired, he's hungry, he sees Jacob cooking some stew. And he says to Jacob, hey, Jacob, can I have some of that stew? I'm super hungry. And Jacob says, well, yeah, sure, if you give me your birthright. Now, birthright is the right of the firstborn son of the family to either get to receive all the physical inheritance or the lion's share of the physical inheritance. And so Esau, being the first out of the womb, he had that right. It was his birthright to receive the inheritance. So now he's hungry. Jacob has food. Jacob says, give me your birthright and I'll give you some stew. And Esau says, sure, whatever. You can have my birthright. And he eats the stew. Now Jacob has received the birthright of the family. It's sort of like in my family. I'm the fifth child. I'm the youngest child, but I'm the third son. I have two older brothers. I was at my mom's recently and talking with her. She's a little bit older, and as elderly people are, they're sort of talking about death all the time. And so she's saying, well, you know, when I die, you know, how do you think I should divide up my money? It's like, I don't know if we should be talking about this, Mom. And she said, well, you know, I have all these grandchildren. Do you think everyone should get an equal share? Like, Mom, I don't want to talk about this. I said, you should talk to my oldest brother, your oldest son, because he's actually in charge of all her finances. That's his responsibility, and basically that's his right. I've sort of given up my right to be involved with my parents' finances because of my older brother. And so Esau has turned over his birthright of his inheritance to his younger brother, Jacob. Now, Isaac does get older, the father, and he feels like he's going to die soon, and he wants to give God's blessing to his eldest son, Esau. Now, the blessing and the birthright are different. So the birthright is about the physical stuff of the family, the property, the animals, any money, things like this. The blessing has been passed down through their family line from God to say, you are going to bless the world through this nation that's going to come through your bloodline. It came through Adam, Esau's grandfather. Now it's come to Isaac. Now it's going to go to Esau. Now, Isaac says, Esau, I'm going to die soon. I want to pass on God's blessing to you. Go out, get some wild game, cook me some stew, and then I'll give you this blessing. So Esau goes out. Rebekah's around the corner, and her favorite son is Jacob. And she hears this, and she's like, well, that ain't going to happen. So she tells Jacob, hey, go get some animals. We're going to cook the stew because your father's about to give us this blessing. So Jacob goes out to the pen, and he gets two goats. He brings them in, and she starts cooking the stew. And he says to his mom, but Esau is hairy, and I got smooth skin, and so what am I supposed to do? She goes, well, get the skin off those goats, put them on your arms, get some of Esau's clothes, and put them on. And so they do this. They go in there, and Esau brings in the stew, and Isaac, the father, says, it doesn't sound like Esau. Esau has this rough, deep voice, right, because he's an outdoorsman. And Jacob has, I don't know, maybe he has a high voice. I don't know. And so should disguise his voice. But he goes in there and he says, "Oh yeah, I'm Esau. And if you feel my hairy arm, he's got this goat skin, right?" And Isaac reaches out and he feels it. And so Esau must have been very hairy. And so he pulls him closer and he smells him. He smells Esau's clothing, the scent of Esau. He says, "This must be Esau." And so, given that Isaac thinks that Jacob is Esau, he gives the blessing to Jacob. He says, through you, God is going to bless the world. You're going to become a great nation. Jacob's got the blessing. Jacob leaves. Esau comes back with a stew. He's like, "Dad, here's a stew. Give me a blessing." Isaac says, "What just happened here? Weren't you just here?" And he says, "What?" And he realizes they've been duped by Jacob. And so Esau is super mad. Right? He's a big, burly guy. He says, "Jacob, I'm going to kill you on the day that our father dies." Rebecca says, "Oh, Jacob, you better leave." And she tells him to leave to to another land where their uncle is. You know, Jacob and Esau, neither of them have any redeeming qualities about them. Esau's a fool. Right? He gives up his birthright for a bowl of stew. Right? Jacob is this deceiver. Like, he knows how to manipulate people. And he says that he stole the blessing from Esau, although his mother was a big part of that. Esau is angry, and he's vengeful. He wants to kill Jacob. And so the solution to his relational problems is to kill his brother. Jacob is scared, and he's frightened. His solution to his relationship problem is to run and to avoid. Now, about 20 years pass, and God calls Jacob back to his homeland. He says, "You need to go back to your homeland." But to get there, Jacob has to go through a region called Edom, E-D-O-M. That's actually where Esau has settled and has created this people group, and they've taken over this land called Edom. So if you read the story in the book of Genesis, it sort of sounds like they have this really great reunion and fixing up of their relationship. But let's look into the story a little bit deeper and see if that's really true. So Jacob gets his animals, his servants, his family together in this huge caravan. They have to go through Edom to get to his homeland. And Genesis chapter 32, verses 3 to 5 tells us this, that Jacob sent messengers ahead to his brother Esau, who was living in the region of Seir in the land of Edom. And he told them, "Give this message to who? My master Esau. Humble greetings from your servant Jacob. Until now I have been living with Uncle Laban, and now I own cattle, donkeys, flocks of sheep and goats, and many servants, both men and women. I have sent these messengers to inform my lord of my coming, hoping that you will be friendly to me." Jacob has no idea what Esau is feeling right now. And so Jacob is putting himself in this sort of subservient position. You can tell by the language that he's using, and with the hopes that Esau will be nice to him. The messengers return and say, "Esau knows you're coming. He has 400 men with him, soldiers." Jacob's terrified. So he divides up his household and all his goods into two groups. And so hopefully if one group is attacked, the other group can get away. And he sends gifts to Esau, verse 14, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 female goats with the young, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys. It's a lot. And sent the servants with this message to Esau, verse 17, "When my brother Esau meets you, he will ask, 'Whose servants are you? Where are you going? Who owns these animals?' And you must reply, 'They belong to your servant, Jacob, but they are a gift for his master, Esau.'" Look, he's right behind us. Now, what's Jacob's concern with Esau? Right? Over 20 years earlier, Jacob says, "When our father dies, you're a dead man too." And so he's fearful of Esau's anger and wrath, and maybe some of you have held anger and resentment in for a long, long, long time. Right? You think 20 years is a long time, but maybe some of you have experienced that even longer. Verse 20 says, we get in Jacob's head. Jacob thought, I will try to appease him by sending gifts ahead of me. When I see him in person, perhaps he will be friendly to me. Right? What's he doing? He's basically attempting to bribe Esau. Here's all the stuff. Here's these animals. Here's these gifts. You know, and be nice to me. Right? Let's, you know, we had a misunderstanding before, right? But we can be friends, right? Story tells us overnight, Jacob wrestles with God. It's a different sermon for another day, but he damages Jacob's hip. And in the morning, the brothers finally approach each other. These two, 400 men in this huge caravan. In verse 3 of chapter 33, as Jacob approached his brother, he bowed down to the ground 7 times before him. And then Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him and threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they both wept. So Jacob comes with this hopeful attitude that Esau will accept the gifts and not kill him, right? He bows down to the ground. Who bows down? A servant to the master, someone who's subservient to someone in authority. So he bows down 7 times, which is a complete number in Scripture. It's a good number. But Esau embraces him and hugs him, and they weep together. Esau asks in verse 5, who are these people with you? And Jacob says, these are the children God has graciously given to me, your servant, Jacob replied. Esau asks again in verse 8, and what were all the flocks and herds that I met as I came? Jacob says, they are a gift, my lord, to ensure your friendship. Esau doesn't need that stuff. He's successful in his own right. In verse 9, he says, keep what you have for yourself. But Jacob insisted, no, if I have found favor with you, please accept this gift from me. And what a relief it is to see your friendly smile. It's like seeing the face of God. And so I think there's some humor here as we read it, right? You know, Jacob's not sure. So if I have found favor, you know, take it, it's okay. You know, I got plenty of stuff and you need more stuff. And he says, it's sort of like kissing up to Esau now. Oh, what a relief it is to see your friendly smile. You're like God. It's like seeing the face of God. It's so amazing to see you. And Esau assumes that Jacob will go back with him to Edom. Hey, come down to my city. We're going to spend some time together, your family and my family. We'll get to know each other. And then in Genesis 33:16, Esau turned around and started back to Seir in Edom that same day. Jacob, on the other hand, traveled on to Succoth, which is the opposite direction, basically. So Jacob, in another act of deceit, he tells Esau, hey, go ahead without me. All my family members, all my children, they're going to be tired if we push them too hard. I'll meet you in Seir. But he goes off in a different direction. Maybe not quite ready to trust his brother. If you read the entire story in detail, you'll notice that Esau calls Jacob my brother a few times. But Jacob is constantly referring to Esau as my lord, my master. He refers to himself as Esau's servant. Well, these are titles of honor, titles of subservience, but they're not terms of endearment, right? When you call someone my master, my lord, it's not a term of endearment. So that and all these gifts that Jacob is trying to give Esau are basically a bribe. In the end, Jacob and Esau don't meet again until the day their father dies, and only then to bury him. Esau never makes good on his threat to kill Jacob. And so we have this story where it's sort of confusing about what actually happened. So I want to remind you of the main idea. You can't have forgiveness without reconciliation, but you cannot have reconciliation without forgiveness. It's interesting in this whole episode between Jacob and Esau that Jacob never asked for forgiveness for his deception, for taking his birthright, taking the blessing. He never asked for his forgiveness. And Esau actually never apologizes for his threats against Jacob. So they have stuff in their past that never comes up, and apparently, if you read it closely, it never gets resolved. There's no forgiveness, and there's no reconciliation. Forgiveness is a necessary first step to move on to healing relationships. So what does the Bible teach us about forgiveness? The first idea is to make forgiveness a priority. Make forgiveness a priority. Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 5, verse 23, if you're presenting a sacrifice to the altar in the temple and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar. Go and be reconciled to that person, then come and offer your sacrifice to God. So in this situation, it's not you did something to someone else. Someone has something against you. In either case, you want to reconcile that situation. And he says, wherever you are, if you're on your way to the temple, stop right there. Resolve the problem, even before you go to church again. So I think what Jesus is telling us here is that restoring relationships are much more important than any religious practice we can do. So he's basically saying you're on your way to church this morning, and in your mind you're thinking about how angry you are at brother or sister that you yelled at yesterday, your classmate, your friend, you're in a big disagreement, neither of you are happy. Basically, Jesus said, stop the car, turn around, and go try to resolve the situation. It should be a priority, that much of a priority. He's almost saying there's something insincere about you coming to church with the sense of an unforgiven relationship. Make it a priority, forgive. Secondly, forgive with a humble spirit and keep it private. Forgive with a humble spirit and keep it private. Humble spirit because, two people argue about something, get mad at each other, there's really no innocent parties. You know, that's true whether it's, husband or wife wanting to get a divorce. They cheated on me, they did this to me, I didn't have any problem, I didn't have any part in it. There's really no innocent party, right? Each of you always have something that contributed to the problem. So Matthew 18 says, if another believer sins against you, go privately and point out the offense. If the other person listens and confesses it, you have won back that person. And the goal is to communicate, I want to resolve this problem. There's something between us. We have an offense going on. We want to resolve it. And the goal is not to make the other person look bad, look foolish, look stupid, look like they're the bad guy, but do it privately. So when you take that approach, what it does, it communicates a lot of grace on your part, right? It's like, hey, let's just do this privately. It's just you and me, right? Communicates a lot of grace, but it also leaves a room for future reconciliation, right? If that person is unwilling to forgive you or to resolve the situation, Scripture does tell us to sort of escalate the situation. Bring witnesses with you. Bring other people who have seen the situation. Bring the church elders in, right? And so the first step it tells us to is to do it privately. The third thing we should do about forgiveness is be willing to ask for forgiveness and forgive if asked. This is really hard, right? And so if you've done something wrong to someone, to say, will you forgive me? Sometimes we use the words, I'm sorry for doing that to you. When you say, do you realize what happens when you say, I'm sorry? So say if I've offended you, I've done something to you, and I say, well, I'm sorry for doing that. That communicates how I feel, right? That communicates how I feel. I'm sorry that I did that, but it doesn't do anything as far as resolving the situation or presenting the need to forgive, right? That's why you really want to try to use the words, will you forgive me or forgive me in that sense? And so Matthew 18 says, Peter came to Jesus and said, Lord, how often shall I forgive someone who sins against me? Seven times? No, not seven times, Jesus said, but 70 times seven. There always has to be a willingness to forgive and to do it clearly and succinctly. So when you forgive someone, you sort of give up your right to enforce justice, even if they offend you 70 times seven times, over and over and over again. Ask for forgiveness and forgive if asked. It's not easy to do, but it's important. I think, and you know, some of you may disagree with me, but I think forgiveness is generally easy to do. One person asks for forgiveness, the other person grants forgiveness. That's sort of easy to do. And I think it's, you know, and more people may disagree with the statement, I think it's possible that you can forgive someone that you'll never see again, that you'll never have any other contact with. That maybe they live on the other side of the world, that they're in a different situation now. They're in a place where you don't really have any future contact with them. I think you can actually forgive that person. I think you can forgive a person who has no intention of asking you to forgive them. Like maybe they're just never going to forgive you. They have no desire to resolve the situation. I think in your heart you can forgive them. I think you can actually forgive someone who's passed away. That you need to resolve the situation. You need to resolve that pain and anger or frustration that you're feeling, and you can forgive in that way. So that's why I say forgiveness is somewhat easy. Reconciliation of relationships is actually more challenging. If I had to define reconciliation, it would be something like this. Reconciliation is a process of restoring a relationship to one that is friendly and compatible and loving and caring and concerning with each other. Right? It's a change of relationship from one that's full of hostility and angst and problems to one of harmony and peace between two parties, right? And so sometimes I have disagreements with my wife. I know it's hard to believe, but sometimes I'll say something stupid or I'll do something stupid. Mostly say something stupid because I don't know why words come out of my mouth sometimes. So I'll say something stupid. It upsets her. It makes her angry. It hurts her feelings. And I can ask for forgiveness. I can say, Mary, will you please forgive me? And she can grant me forgiveness. Yes, I forgive you. But then the hard work starts. Forgiveness is not the same as reconciliation. And I think some of you realize that. Because I can ask for forgiveness, she can grant me forgiveness. But we have to work on healing that part of the relationship that was broken. So forgiveness does not automatically lead toward reconciliation. So please understand me when I say reconciliation requires hard work. It requires an effort from you. Reconciliation is when you take this damaged relationship and you want to heal it. Not necessarily make it the same way it was before, but you want to heal it, right? And so to make it friendly and compatible and healthy. So you and the other person have to figure out how to move into a healthy place or a healthy relationship with one another. It could be as simple as sitting down and talking about the situation. It could be as simple as let's go have a meal together, agreeing not to hold things against each other, that sort of thing. But it takes a little bit of work there. So when you successfully go through the reconciliation process, sometimes your relationship has the potential of being actually better than it was before. But if you avoid the reconciliation process or you can't figure out how to be healthy, the hurt party can be more resentful than they were before. And it's possible that the relationship can be deeply or permanently damaged, or maybe even it's possible that true forgiveness wasn't granted. So you try to restore a relationship to a healthy place. Okay. Why is true reconciliation difficult? Because when you think about forgiveness, forgiveness is sort of the spiritual act. You ultimately rely on God's grace to accomplish it. We forgive because God has forgiven us. And when you choose to forgive, there's healing that takes place inside your heart, right? It's a spiritual healing. It's an inner healing. It's personal healing. And so forgiveness in itself is a spiritual act. That's why I think it's possible you can ask for forgiveness for someone you may never encounter again. Reconciliation, however, is a relational act, right? It takes at least two people. You have to reconcile with another person or another party, right? It's not just asking for and receiving forgiveness. It's working towards a better, healthy relationship. So one person could be completely willing to reconcile, but if the other person is not willing, you'll never reconcile. You'll never have a healthy relationship. So our motivation to reconcile should be because of the reconciliation that God has with us. So Colossians 1:20 tells us that through Jesus, God reconciled everything to himself, and he made peace with everything in heaven and on earth by means of Christ's blood on the cross. God is reconciled to us through Jesus, right? And everything is made peaceful. God knows that it's not just forgiveness that makes the relationship, it's reconciliation, to come to a peaceful, loving relationship again. So let me ask you, maybe just spend a moment. Is there a person or persons in your life that you struggle because you can't grant them forgiveness, or they're unwilling to grant you forgiveness? Like there's been a break in your relationship and forgiveness is at the center of that issue. And ask yourself, why is this happening? Why can't I grant forgiveness? Why aren't they granting me forgiveness? Right? Ask yourself that. And when you think about these relationships that have been maybe damaged to something and you've tried to seek forgiveness, have they come to a point where you're reconciled? Are they healthy? Are you at the point where you can say to them and to yourself, we're at a good place, right? And as these pictures of people come to your mind, can you just pray for that relationship? Pray that there would be forgiveness and reconciliation. And if you're a Christian, you say to yourself, because God has reconciled all things to himself, I can reconcile to these people. In the Old Testament, the word reconciliation is the Hebrew word kafar. Kafar is translated into many different English meanings, forgive, purge away, to be merciful, that sort of idea. But the most commonly translated English word for kafar is the word atonement. Atonement. And atonement is the returning to a harmonious relationship with God, specifically with God. Returning to a harmonious relationship with God. So when Jesus Christ died for us on the cross, he made the way for us to have an eternal, harmonious relationship with God because he was the ultimate atonement for us. Romans chapter 5, verse 1 tells us, since we have been made right in God's sight by faith, we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ our Lord has done for us. Because of our faith, Christ has brought us into this place of undeserved privilege where we now stand, and we confidently and joyfully look forward to sharing God's glory. We have been made right in God's sight, and we have peace with God. We have this reconciled relationship. The Apostle Paul goes on to write in verse 6, when we were utterly helpless, Christ came at just the right time and died for us sinners. Now most people will not be willing to die for an upright person, though someone might perhaps be willing to die for a person who is especially good. But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners. And since we have been made right in God's sight by the blood of Christ, he will certainly save us from God's condemnation. God showed his great love for us. We've been made right in God's eyes. And in chapter 5, verse 10, for since our friendship with God was restored by the death of his son, while we were still his enemies, we will certainly be saved through the life of his son. So now we can rejoice in our wonderful new relationship with God because our Lord Jesus Christ has made us friends with God. Jesus shed his blood for us to bring us into a relationship with God that has no conflict, that has peace, that calls us to be sons and daughters and friends of God. It's an amazing thing. It's a supernatural thing. It is something that Jesus did that's beyond explanation, beyond words. We never want to forget that. Ever, ever, ever. That Jesus was our ultimate atonement to bring us into a right and peaceful relationship with him. And so we take communion. Communion is the representation of what we do to remember Jesus, that as he gave us his body and shed his blood for us, we have the opportunity to remember that over and over and over again. Scripture tells us to examine your heart, to examine where you are with him. Are there things in your heart that that you need to bring before God? Specifically this morning, I would ask that you would bring people before God. A person that you're struggling with, having difficulties with. And just say to yourself, God, you forgave me through Jesus. Help me to restore this relationship. Invite you to come up and to participate in communion today if you are a baptized believer. So if you're not a baptized believer, we simply ask that you don't partake today. If you're not a believer, I ask that you would think about why God would love sinners so much. What kind of God that we hold fast to. As the servers come up, I want to ask that you clear the floor. Put your stuff underneath your chair so no one trips over anything. Okay. Service, please.